rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up on today's podcast, part 5 of the political editors. Really good chat with Roland Watson, although I've got to say that because he's now my editor on the comment desk. But he talks about being political editor of the Times for the fall of Gordon Brown, the formation of the coalition, and the first whiff that something might be going on with David Cameron and Europe. Also, an amazing story about interviewing George W. Bush in the Oval Office. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as ever, let's kick off with the columnists.
The columnists on Times Radio.
Yeah, no James Marriott today. He is elsewhere, bashing away at his column. However, we have got India Knight. Morning, India.
Morning, Matt.
Guys, Toby with us. And from The Guardian columnist, Gabby Hinsliff. Morning, Gabby.
Good morning.
Nice to have you both here. Now, I suppose we should start with the extraordinary mugshot of Donald Trump, because it's so Donald Trump. It's like it's an advert for a slightly naff TV show that he's doing. But here is the Times New York correspondent, Will Pavia, trying to describe it.
Donald Trump is sort of glowering slightly towards the camera. His hair is sort of catching the light. His eyebrows are sort of knit together. And he's sort of staring straight down the barrel of the camera and sort of frowning at the guy taking the, or whoever it was, taking the mugshot.
Now, is this going to become the most famous mugshot since Hugh Grant, India?
Yes, I'm afraid it is, because, you know, the thing about photographs is lots and lots and lots of words are produced all the time about Donald Trump, but people aren't going to read the paperwork of the various indictments or necessarily all the comment pieces or all of the news or all of the stuff. But a photograph sticks in the memory, and this is a fairly indelible photograph, I think. He looks absolutely extraordinary. He looks so like a bird. He's all sort of pointy. And I think he's trying to look like a badass, you know, with that sort of silly facial expression.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, it's instantly memorable, and alas, will remain instantly memorable for many decades to come.
Gabby, I'm just disappointed he's not holding up some numbers. That for me, it's not a proper mugshot if he's not holding up his prison number.
I know, I'm very disappointed about that. It does, I mean, the astonishing thing, the obviously incredibly Trump thing about it, is that they've punted it almost as a kind of, you know, as a kind of positive, you know, look how belligerent he looks, America is coming at you. You know, he's kind of coming to answer all his critics, like it's some kind of, you know, strongman piece of propaganda rather than, you know, sort of a criminal mugshot. It's astonishing, really. Although what I mainly wondered about when I saw the description was, along with an American mugshot, they give you the person's height and weight as well. And I am sure I would be willing to bet that he argued with them about putting the height up and the weight down.
because he wears lifts, doesn't he? He very obviously wears lifts in his shoes. I mean, he's quite tall, but he's not as tall as he makes out to be. And there was that, when he was still president, there was that report from his doctor that had his weight at kind of athlete level.
Yeah, 15 stone, I don't think so. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, just not quite putting both feet on the scales. In some mugshots I've seen, they actually have like a tape measure behind, so there'd be no arguing at all about how tall he was. But yeah, there is, I mean, I suppose the point that you were making, India, is that it is extraordinary that we're in the situation now, and his extraordinary power to sort of absorb attention and the news and turn every negative into a positive, that he, you know, he's returned to Twitter for the first time in like two, three years in order to post this photo, like you said, to weaponize it to his own benefit. I mean, it is impossible to imagine, I think, possibly anyone else being able to turn being arrested, indicted, charged, and then mugshotted and turn it into essentially an election poster.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's beyond through the looking glass, you know. But I think what he did during his term was that he degraded America. He degrades everything he touches. He degraded America. He degraded American politics. The aftermath of that is still being felt because all of the would-be Republican nominees are also so degraded that they won't call him out. So they're all kind of, you know, at that debate the other day, they're all kind of there in a row, Trump-light, pathetically wet, refusing to say anything against him. So the kind of the dominance of his upside-down world is kind of complete. You know, I find it really extraordinary. It makes me feel physically ill, but I sort of can't look away because it's so crazy. It's crazy. It's a crazy situation. And I find it particularly crazy that nobody from the Republican Party in the US says this man is completely appalling. Please vote for somebody else.
And that's the thing.
That would be an outrageous thing to say. It would just be a statement of fact. So it's the whole thing, you know, we're trapped in this kind of doom spiral of catastrophe, I think.
And actually, there's an interesting thing, Gabby, that the journey that the Republican Party clearly needs to go on is a long way to go before they're ready to say enough is enough. Actually, in a way, it's a slightly lazy comparison between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, mostly based on hair, although they have both potentially broken the law. But actually, the Conservative Party came round to the idea that actually maybe Boris Johnson wasn't the solution to everything much more quickly and has sought to move on a bit. Actually, in a way, the Republican Party is still a long, long way from that, based on that presidential debate that we had this week.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had as usual in the UK, we had a much milder dose of whatever it is that the US has got. And you kind of, you know, so we were over it quicker. But I think there's a fascinating book called Mistakes Were Made by Not By Me, about by a psychologist, about why kind of people find it hard to admit they were wrong or change their minds. And it starts with this study of a doomsday cult, you know, one of those cults that says, you know, the world's going to end on a very precise, you know, at 10 past 10 on Tuesday, September the 15th or whatever it is. And then, of course, it came around to Tuesday, September 15th, and the world did not end. And you'd expect at that point the cult's followers, you know, who've given up all their money and possessions and moved off into the woods to live off berries or whatever, and the understanding that the end of the world is coming, to like turn on their cult leader. And actually what happened was reverse. They doubled down. They believed it more. It's just the date was wrong, but they still believed in the apocalyptic cult, because otherwise you'd have to admit that you'd kind of sold everything down the river for something that turned out to be nonsense. And what's that make you? That makes you an idiot. And you can see some of that, I think, in Trump followers, you know, to believe they thought he was going to make America great again. If they were wrong and he was a charlatan, then what does that make them? That makes you an idiot, you know. So you kind of double down and believe more, almost in contravention of the evidence.
That's really interesting, isn't it, India, that the journey that people have to go on. Actually, you know, we've seen that bit with Brexit, that it's taken quite a long time for people who voted for Brexit to now say it's not worked. And actually, you know, what you see with your Nigel Farage, they say it just hasn't been done properly because they don't want to acknowledge, to acknowledge the thing has not panned out as they promised.
I think also people are so grateful for any politician who comes along and makes them feel that they're being heard, which is, you know, Trump's superpower, even though it's kind of completely fraudulent, because actually he does not feel their pain, and he just wants their vote and their money. But it's always the same. You know, these people come along, not very many of them, which says something interesting about the rest of politics, and somehow really, really connect with people who are struggling. And as Gabby says, I think that's exactly right. You know, to at any point go, oh, God, actually, this man is talking complete nonsense, and none of what he says is true, and none of what he promised has come to pass, turns you into even more of a failure than you feel already. So you've got to stick with it and stick with the person, even as you just, you know, even as you, the crevice opens and you all fall down it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's a terrible state of affairs.
Yeah, it's a lot about the psychology of the public in general. Let's move on, because I'm really interested in what you make of imposter syndrome. Nobody would accuse, I don't think, well, Donald Trump or Boris Johnson are suffering from imposter syndrome. But Michael Parkinson's son has said that his father suffered from imposter syndrome and was racked with self-doubt. He's been giving an interview after, obviously, Sir Michael died earlier this month at the age of 88, saying his father, telling BBC his father didn't have as much self-confidence as he appeared to have on TV. Do you think imposter syndrome is a real thing, India?
Oh, I think it's really real. And actually, I slightly mistrust people who don't have it. I think women in particular suffer from it, I think, more than men. But I think it's quite a good thing, you know. I think if you don't suffer from imposter syndrome at all ever, then you are, as it were, Donald Trump, and that is not good. Or you're a particular kind of unbelievably entitled person, possibly the product of a particular kind of school and or university, who just kind of struts around the world believing they're God's gift. And those people are really intolerable. So, you know, a bit of imposter syndrome is quite a nice personality trait, I think.
What do you think, Abby?
I'd agree with that only because I have it. But yeah, I think it's...
It's not for me to say. It's really India's place to say something.
But no, I think I've probably spent my whole career thinking I was about to be sacked any minute. And eventually you just sort of get used to it and assume that, that, you know, things will carry on much as they are. And when and if you do get sacked, that's just life. But I think the fascinating thing about Parkinson is you assume that kind of men in television, especially kind of big, seemingly alpha male personalities in a starring role on TV, would be, you know, uber confident, kind of oozing kind of arrogance almost. And you forget that, you know, Michael Parkinson was a minor son from Barnsley, you know, in the BBC at a time when the BBC was still quite class ridden, was still, you know, it's not that far from the days of all BBC announcers wearing bow ties and DJs and, you know, speaking in RP. And to come to have a Yorkshire accent, even at that time within the BBC, was a big deal, you know. And I think you can understand why he felt, I think his son said he always felt that he wasn't as well educated or didn't have the polish or didn't have, or that his bosses didn't kind of think he was a good enough interviewer. And you can see where those obviously misplaced doubts came from. But I always think it's rather touching when people confess to that, because I think lots of people have those kind of same secret doubts and insecurities. And don't talk to anybody about it. So it's kind of reassuring to know that other people feel the same, which is why I always admit to having them myself.
There is also that sort of slight sense of it, that actually part of the reason why he was so good, because if it manifests itself, as his son suggested, that he always thought that this, you know, people were questioning, should he be doing it? Should he be on the telly still? Should he be doing it? Actually, it made him better. You know, it made him work harder at it. The people who don't have that slither of self-doubt coast and then get less good. Well, up next, we're going to test your self-confidence when it comes to maths, because GCSE results came out obviously this week. Thousands of teenagers in England, Wales and Northern Ireland got the results yesterday. But it wasn't just young people who take the qualifications. Keith Dibble is a Labour councillor in Rushmore and took an English GCSE, got his results yesterday at the age of 68. Hi, Keith.
Morning, Matt.
Well, go on then, tell us, how did you get on?
Well, I got grade 7, which in old terminology is an A, and I got a distinction in public speaking, which I'm really pleased with. But this imposter syndrome, I think, it could be me, really, because I went through, you know, left school with one O-level and a handful of CSEs, which shows my age, and ended up as a sort of a senior manager in industry and you know, quite a leading local politician, but always felt a little bit inferior, and at times very inferior when I'd be going into a board meeting. So I hadn't really was aware of this imposter syndrome until yesterday, but I think I could tick that box as well. And that was one of the reasons for going back to college, or going to college for the first time.
Well, congratulations on getting your grades this time around. Now, we thought, well, let's test our own... somebody thought I should be tested. That's basically what actually happened here. So we're not going to do an English essay because that'll take far too long. So you've got some maths questions.
I have indeed.
And I've got as long as the break to try and answer them. So if you give us the question, and Gabby and India, you are very welcome to join in.
Yeah. But if you're literally going to be no help. No help.
I think you'll need a double ad break. But anyway, let's
go. Come on then. Give us the question.
Question one then.
Right, pens and papers are ready. Go on.
Are you ready, guys? Yeah. What is minus 3 times 3?
What is minus 3 times 3? Okay.
Question 1. Question 2. Which of these angles is the largest? Right angle, reflex angle, obtuse angle, acute angle.
Right, reflex, obtuse, acute. Right. Oh, my God. Right, yeah.
Number 3. You'll love this one.
Right.
Shona has 14 dresses.
Right.
50% of these are red. She gives 5 of her red dresses to a charity shop. She buys 1 new red dress. What percentage of the dresses she has are now red?
Right, tell you what, Keith, do that one once more.
Right, slowly.
Yeah.
Shona has 14 dresses.
Yeah.
50% of these are red. She gives 5 of her red dresses to a charity shop. Then she buys 1 new red dress. What percentage of the dresses she now has are red?
This is Times Radio.
It's Matt Cholley on Times Radio having a nightmare with maths. So, Keith is on the line. Keith, you still there?
Yeah.
Keith did
waiting with interest your answers.
68, did a GCSE in English, got a grade 7 yesterday, which is really, I mean, was it a lot of work, Keith?
It was the biggest challenge, I think. I retired from sort of paid work summer of last year. I always had this sort of inferiority complex. So I thought I'd go to college, did the assessment. But day one of going into a classroom after 50-odd years was quite daunting. But actually the class itself was a mixture of like a third were young people doing multiple subjects. A third were doing it for career advancement. They wanted to become a dental nurse or something like that, and a third of us were doing it for fun, and some camaraderie was created in the group. But yeah, it was hard doing homework and also having to handwrite everything when you've spent the last 20 years using computers and such things. Yeah,
well, I'll tell you what, Keith, I'm basically buying time here to try, but there's no good. We're gonna have to get on it. So I should say actually that years ago when I was at the Taunton Times around this time, we got the whole office to either do a maths or an English GCSE. Yeah. And I did a maths one. I think I got a B.
Well done.
Right, so come on then. So let's do the questions then. What was question number one?
Right. What is minus 3 times 3?
India or Gabby, do you want to have a go?
I think, bearing in mind, I've got a son who did maths GCSE this year, but bearing in mind also that I am absolutely atrocious at maths, I think if you times a number by a negative number, the answer is always negative.
Yeah.
In which case it's minus 9.
I've also written down minus 9. India?
I went round the back of the bike sheds for a fag.
Oh, India was one of the cool girls. Yeah. Oh, no.
You know, Keith, I'm so admiring of Keith. I haven't got a maths O level. I sat it 3 times and I couldn't get it. And when I got to university and they gave me this kind of micro scholarship, they said, this is all very great, etc., but you're going to have to get a maths O level. And then happily they forgot. So I am literally ignorant to my eternal shame.
So go on then, Keith. What's the answer?
Minus 9.
Yay! We've got right. Okay.
That's the only one I'm going to get right.
Right. Question 2, Keith.
Which of these angles is the largest? Right angle, reflex angle, obtuse angle, and acute angle?
India.
I don't know. I didn't even know reflex angle existed.
I must admit, I didn't know. I've gone obtuse.
Yeah, I said reflex because I don't know what 2 of those are. So, you know.
Right. Keith.
Reflex, it goes backwards.
Well, of course, Gabby is our champion. It is reflex.
Oh, well done. So that's Gabby's,
it's amazing what you can do on a flute.
Gabby's got two, and Matt's got one. Still into your nothing. Right, so last question then, Keith.
Right, Shona has 14 dresses.
Yeah.
50% of these are red.
Yeah.
She gives 5 of her red dresses to a charity shop.
Yeah.
She buys 1 new red dress. What percentage of the dresses she has are now red?
So just because I'm conscious of the time, I'm going to go through my maths. 14 dresses, 50% of red is 7. She gives 5 away, which means she's got 2 red dresses left out of 9. 1 more red dress is 10. So I think she's got 3 out of 10, which is 30%.
Correct.
Hey! So I've given the game away now. Gabby, what was your answer?
Oh, I thought it was 3 out of the total. I got to 3, and then I thought it was 3 out of the total of dresses, which is 14 plus the one she's got, which is 3 out of 15, which
no,
is 20.
No, but she's given 5 away, isn't she? She's given
5. I know, but I thought it was counted all the dresses in the question. No.
Gabby Hinsliff from The Guardian and India Knight from The Sunday Times. You can read her every week. Of course, just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is part 5 of The Political Editors.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast now. It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
Hooray! It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth, growth, and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. In this episode, Roland Watson on interviewing Bush in the Oval Office, the birth of the coalition, and The Times official election artist.
roller coaster of extraordinary stories, but a sort of an inexorable route to the downfall of the Tories and the incoming of Labour. For these events, we didn't just turn up with a photographer, but we turned up with an artist as well. He just made a speech. He was in an absolutely filthy mood. I mean, it was the first peacetime coalition for 80 years eventually got an interview with Bush in the Oval Office. And at the end of the interview, he said, "All right, come over," and opened a drawer and started producing baseballs and commemorative postcards.
So, Roland Watson, you became political editor in January 2010. Succeeding Phil Webster, who'd been there for about 200 years. What was it like taking over as political editor, having worked with him so close for such a long time?
Pretty terrifying, to be honest. I joined the Times in 1998 as a political correspondent. I was at the time on the Express, and so where I was political editor, but I joined as a political correspondent. I'd always wanted to work for the Times, really. And I joined this most illustrious team involving Phil and Peter Riddle, and Matthew Paris was sketching. So I'd worked with Phil very closely, both in Westminster, and then I went from there to Washington, but was obviously working very closely with him while he was in Westminster.
Yeah,
I was taking over from a legend.
And replacing such a big name like Phil Webster, political editor for such a long time, what did you learn from him? What skills did you take from Phil?
Well, some skills that were entirely personal and very difficult to learn. Phil had an uncanny ability to read silences or even read body language and know what was behind it. He came very excited into our porter cabin in Westminster one afternoon, notably so, shall we say. "What's up?" He said, I've just seen George Jones walking down the corridor." George Jones was his long-term rival and friend, who was the political editor of the Daily Telegraph. "What?" "He was walking down the corridor in a funny way." "I know he's got something." And Phil devoted the rest of the afternoon to making it his business to find out what story George Jones had got in his pocket, and not only to beat it, to better it, so that the next day's front page of the Telegraph duly splashed with George's story, and the Times splashed with Phil's slightly improved version. And that's probably a skill you can't really teach, but that is how to be a good political editor.
I suppose taking over in 2010, on the cusp of the end of the sort of Labour government, it was almost going full circle, because when you joined the lobby in the early 90s, it was the end of the Tory era and the sort of the rise of New Labour.
Yeah, it was, very much. I mean, there was the 5 years of the major parliament was a sort of roller coaster of extraordinary stories, but a sort of an inexorable route to the downfall of the Tories and the incoming of Labour. And you're right. I mean, at that stage in January, Labour certainly hadn't given up hope.
Yeah.
Brown and his team thought that even after 13 years themselves, they still had a good story to sell, which was largely amounted to Gordon Brown saving the world after the financial crash.
"And we not only saved the world, saved the banks and saved the banks."
The election campaign that followed was absolutely fascinating. It became a genuine three-horse race. We had the first televised debates, which gave Clegg his moment of oxygen. And really, right to the end, the election was pretty hard to call.
And actually, I mean, certainly in the time, so I've been in the lobby for almost 20 years now, and probably the 2010 election is the one where, during the campaign, nobody knew what was going to happen. There have been other elections where we thought we knew what was going to happen, and then it didn't happen to be the case. But a genuine open contest, the ups and downs of the campaign, the novelty of the TV debates. And presumably, if you're the political editor, the new political editor of the Times in 2010, does everybody want to speak to you?
Up to a point. There was a rather fabulous tradition of the editor interviewing every party leader, along with a political editor. And for these events, we didn't just turn up with a photographer, but we turned up with an artist as well. so that the interview would be displayed across two pages of the Times inside, with this artist's sketch as the main image on the page. A guy called Matthew Cook, who'd also drawn sketches for the Times from conflict zones. And two of the party leaders were very keen to talk to us. So we got Cameron and Clegg under our belts quite early on in the campaign. Gordon Brown was incredibly reluctant. He really did not want to do this interview. And we entered the last week of the campaign with me still pretty much begging by that stage. And there was always, it couldn't be fitted in. There was a diary complication. It was just too much trouble. But Gordon, he'd really fallen out with the Times. We had, partly because we had, during the campaign, endorsed the Tories. Anyway, I did, it, during that last week, I got a phone call at about 8:30 in the morning from a number 10 guy saying, all right, you can have the interview. We've got a tiny bit of time at this college in Leamington Spa, but you have to be there by 11:30. And it was pretty much mission impossible. and it was designed for us to fail and for them to be able to say, well, we offered. But anyway, James Harding, who was the editor at the time, was game for anything. So we scrambled, made it there somehow. And at that stage...
With the artist?
With the artist, absolutely with the artist. He scrambled as well. Everyone played their role. At that stage, I'm not even sure the number 10 guys had told the Prime Minister that this interview was going to take place because they'd assumed we wouldn't make it. He just made a speech. He was in an absolutely filthy mood. It was the last thing he wanted to do. We pulled up some chairs, and for about 20, 25 minutes, he just sort of thundered at us. We asked a few questions, none of which got answered, and he just delivered a very Brownian script. I want to talk about serious issues. I'm not going to talk about personalities or titbits. I'm only here to talk about serious issues. And he delivered his script again and again. So not everyone wanted to speak to us.
I was just sort of reflecting back, because it was clearly a time where Labour really did want to speak to the Times, and Phil cultivated those relationships. So both the Blairites and the Brownites sort of had him on speed dial. When you were a junior political correspondent and everyone went to Phil, how did you sort of navigate your way through that?
Well, first of all, it was a wonder to see how Phil kept up contacts with both sides of an increasingly dysfunctional party, but also with the Tories. It was masterful. I mean, in a sense, that was one of my favourite jobs, being political correspondent, because you had enormous freedom to roam around and make your own fun, as it were. It was finding stuff that no one else had. It had been very useful starting in the lobby, working for local papers, yeah, a string of local papers. So when I joined, I had a lot of sort of backbench or junior minister type contacts who I knew quite well. That was helpful.
Yeah, similarly, you end up with these sort of little pockets of MPs who no one else has ever bothered speaking to. I seem to be the only journalist who knew who Geoffrey Cox was when he appeared in the news. So let's go back to 2010 then. Labour on the way out, the Tories were on the way in. How did you find David Cameron?
Enormously confident, personable. I think overall, slightly more diligent than he's often given credit for, but with a slight seat-of-the-pants quality to the way he went about his business. There was something in the sort of the SA crisis prime minister. My brilliant colleague at the time and successor, Francis Elliott, who rather brilliantly nailed that in a single word when, in his biography of Cameron, he dubbed him the king of chillaxing, which was very apposite and stuck and rung true.
You mentioned him earlier, but there was another person in this marriage, in Nick Clegg. And how do you think you, the Times, the lobby generally, coped in those early days of having a coalition?
With some difficulty. It was, to start with, it was quite hard to understand how this was going to work.
Yeah, how long it would survive.
I mean, it was the first peacetime coalition for 80 years. No one involved in either constructing it or covering it knew the procedure, if there was a procedure. And that first joint appearance they made at the end of what had been a very grueling campaign and then 5 days of coalition talks, when they appeared looking like spring daisies in the Downing Street garden.
Prime Minister, do you now regret when once asked what your favourite joke was, you replied Nick Clegg? And Deputy Prime Minister, what do you think of that?
We're all going to have. I'm afraid I did once. Right.
A lot of the questions then were, well, where are the Lib Dems going to sit? I mean, they only ever sat in one place in the Commons. How are the ministries going to work? Who is going to be in charge of whipping the Lib Dems or whipping the Tories? What would the sanctions be? And you know, to their credit, they made it work for 5 full years. But at the start, it was exciting and interesting to cover because every department, you know, most departments had a Lib Dem in them. There were these strange marriages of convenience all around Whitehall. A lot of Tory MPs absolutely hated it. But Cameron and Clegg both quite enjoyed their jobs and, for better or for worse, saw it through to the end.
And at that point, one of the really striking things in politics that we haven't really had that before or since was that all three parties were interesting. And so you sort of had this constant, it felt like you were sort of constantly, you know, spinning plates of who was you going to pick the phone up to today, rather than, you know, for large periods, you know, what was the point of speaking to the Tories during the new Labour years or whatever. Did you find that you had sort of Clegg, Cameron and Miliband? I mean, Miliband, one of his biggest problems was that he was the third most interesting man in politics.
Yeah, he was, and that was a real problem for Labour in terms of projection and how they sold Miliband. And given the commitment and then the legislation to a 5-year parliament, that was a long time when the lobby and the public really didn't need to pay much attention to Ed Miliband, because they had this sort of living drama, living experiment going on in front of them. I mean, the one thing there was in the lobby was a sort of emergency making of Liberal Democrat contacts, which was a very minority.
Some of us always had those.
Indeed, I bow to you. But that had been a minority pursuit up to that point.
It was normally the most junior person in any team would make it their business because no one else had, and suddenly...
Yeah. Or the peers.
Exactly.
Or both.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at your time in the lobby, there's always the danger of thinking that the thing that's happening right now is the biggest thing that's ever happened. In terms of the big events that you covered, both as Pothead, but before that as well, obviously the formation of the coalition, the financial crash, 9/11, which are the ones that you think really did change politics and the country?
9/11, on a more personal level, happened in the first week that I had turned up in the Times' Washington Bureau. So I had sort of 4 years in Washington of really being completely dominated by 9/11 and covering Bush. And I think the experience of reporting in Washington certainly coloured how I later saw Westminster. Westminster feels like a goldfish bowl. It's one of the most attractive things about it, that everything moves is important and you can sort of newsify any cough and spit. Washington is very different to that, not just because there's much more deference towards the office holder, who's a head of state as well as a head of government. The White House press corps still stand up when the president enters the room. But they have a much different view of the world, like being on Mount Olympus in Washington. You turn up to the State Department and there are incredibly smart American officials who understand the socioeconomics of the tiniest African state and the ethnic differences across Southeast Asia. And they are fantastically literate. And from there, London does seem quite parochial, a bit like a parish council. And so then coming back to Westminster later, it was odd going back into the goldfish bowl and sort of getting back into the swing of things.
And how was it being a British journalist reporting for a British paper from Washington in terms of the Blair-Bush relationship and some of the characterisation in the UK being that, you know, Blair was the poodle and just following Bush and so on?
Mr. Prime Minister, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. And, well, I was delighted to come here and
I've been really enthusiastic about our meetings so far. They've been absolutely excellent, very productive.
Was that how Blair and Britain was being seen in America?
Not at all. Blair was lionized and regarded as passionate, as fluent. I mean, George Bush, I have to say, I loved reporting Bush. He was a walking story. You know, he couldn't walk into a room without committing news. And
not always intentionally.
No, he was very misunderestimated, as he might have put it, by the Brits. I always fought a losing battle, a bit with the foreign desk, about actually how smart a communicator I thought Bush was. I thought he was always going to win that second election, hands down. The impression of Blair was completely different, the way we treated him as sort of rolling over for Bush and the respect with which he was treated over there. But being a British reporter there, it's a very, very different role because, as you say, you know, you hope as the Times political editor, everyone wants to speak to you. Very, very hard to get an audience there. And in fact, your best hope is actually trying to get an audience with the president himself, occasionally once a year or once every 2 years, British newspaper will be granted an audience. And I sweated blood leaning on the one person in the National Security Council who might be able to help. Eventually got an interview.
With Bush?
With Bush, in the Oval Office, with Jerry Baker, who at the time was our Washington commentator. And so we had a reasonable chat for quite a long time. And at the end of the interview, he said, "Oh, right, come over here." So he took us from the sort of the twin armchairs by the fireplace, if you like, to his desk and opened a drawer and started producing baseballs and commemorative postcards. And he said, "What are your kids' names?" So I said, "I've got two daughters and their names." He signed notes to them. He signed baseballs for them, and I did wonder if this was the best use of the president's time. Then he sent to Jerry and he said, "Right, and what about your kids?" Now Jerry's got five daughters, so that really did hold us up quite a bit at the end.
Does he have an endless supply of baseballs in that drawer?
Apparently endless, enough for seven at one shot anyway.
And so then you come back, you pull Ed's Gordon Brown. I mean, I get the sense that Gordon Brown might have thrown a baseball at you rather than sign one. When you go in to interview the Prime Minister in Downing Street, do you get the same treatment?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's a bit more knowing. You know, you're not meeting them for the first time, and the terrain is better understood. They understand the game much better. You understand the game. You know where you're trying to take them. They're extremely aware where they're trying not to go. So, no, it's a bit different.
Of course, one of the big political stories, more after you left as Paul Ed, was the story of Europe. And David Cameron Macy kept a lid on that during most of the coalition times. But it was always bubbling around in the background.
It was. And it, there was the extraordinary Brussels summit towards the end of 2011, I think it was, when the 27 leaders sat through the night. It was a very arcane discussion. It was about whether new fiscal rules for the Eurozone should be written into EU treaties, the sort of stuff that summits are made of. It wasn't built up as a big summit, but they didn't break up. They went on, and as dawn broke, it emerged that Cameron had vetoed the outcome.
I said before coming to Brussels that if I couldn't get adequate safeguards for Britain in a new European treaty, then I wouldn't agree to it.
And UKIP was on the rise at home. He clearly had a problem with a wing of his party. And he had just completely recast our relationship with Europe in the sense that we were now an isolated single state, even the non-Eurozone countries we were against. And that was incredibly dramatic at the time. And I remember later that morning, Cameron's spokesman, Steve Field, briefing us all in one of the side rooms. The expectation, given Cameron's words and his actions, was that this was putting us on, putting him personally on a collision course with the EU, and that he would indeed begin to seek a way out. And that was the assumption in the lobby. And Steve came in and said, well, no, don't misunderstand it. This man is passionately pro-European. He doesn't want to leave the EU. And so you had a leader who'd won the Tory crown by playing footsie with the Eurosceptics, had just isolated Britain in Europe. There was talk of a referendum already or a rearrangement with Europe in the background. And yet he appeared to be someone who personally was committed to keeping Britain in. And you thought at that stage, well, how on earth is that going to work? Doesn't seem to stack up in domestic political terms. And indeed, from there, we know what happened.
And I suppose it was one of those things that so much of what David Cameron said and did in those years leading up to the referendum were about how terrible the EU was. They won't let us do that. They won't let us do this. I've had to use a veto. I've had to call for a break. And so his argument then ended up being, this is a terrible organisation and that's why we should stay in it.
Yeah, that's what you got a first hint of in that with the use of that veto and its aftermath. And it was very hard to stack up as an argument. Anyone else other than Cameron may have shied away from it, but he had extraordinary confidence, extraordinary personal belief, and thought that he could, all he had to do was put it to the country and the power of his personality would win the day.
And just looking ahead then, based on your experience of 2010, although the polls would suggest a stonking Labour victory the next election, I wonder whether you think, which actually was the expectation in 2010, that the Conservatives were going to get a majority because nobody could imagine a hung parliament happening. Is it underpriced? You know, should your successors in the lobby be dusting off their Lib Dem contacts book again for an election campaign where the outcome is unknown and a coalition could be on the cards?
Well, looking at it from a distance, the numbers this time are very different. And yes, it's 13 years, which is analogous, and a newish prime minister who's been unelected by the people. That was also the case with
Gordon
Brown.
Chancellor.
And a former chancellor. This time the Tories have got a long way to come back, much further than Labour did. And I also think that the Lib Dems are not going to be jumping into bed with anyone in the same way that they did last time very soon. I think it's going to take probably another generation before they do that again.
You used a phrase, looking from a distance. You went from being political editor to foreign editor in 2013, now comment editor, which means I have to pitch my column to you every week. Do you prefer your politics from a distance these days rather than being at the centre of it all?
I do miss the big days. There's nothing quite like it. It's incredibly exciting being in Westminster. And I never felt anything but privilege.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Being able to go and work there. In a funny way, I also miss the quiet days when you could just hang around in the lobby, see who turned up, see what they had
to say.
Without
the news desk, be able to see what you're doing.
I have to say, I am in awe of Steve Swinford and his team, how they manage the demands of the digital age and social media and stay across everything and on top of everything. It's really quite a skill.
Well, Roland Watson, it's been lovely to speak to you, and I shall be speaking to you again later when I have to pitch my column to you. Roland Watson, thanks very much for joining us on The Political Editors.
Pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget you can catch up on all the previous episodes of The Political Editors, and we've got two more next week. We'll have Francis Elliott and the current political editor, Stephen Swinford. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.